The following program is a Zygon International audio presentation.
Everyone is a creature of myth. The ancient legends and tales of the race are still the master keys to the human psyche. Mythology reveals humanity's deepest longings, fears, sorrows, joys, and hopes. If we are to understand ourselves, we have to know our myths. For the past half century, Joseph Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Sarah Lawrence College, has been a dedicated student and teacher of mythology. More than any other single individual, he has brought mythology into the mainstream of American thought through his prolific works, including the classic four-volume work entitled The Masks of God, the best-selling Hero with a Thousand Faces, The Mythic Image, and Myths to Live By. He has edited numerous works, including Philosophies of India, The Portable Jung, and The Portable Arabian Nights. At 80 years of age, Joseph Campbell is still moving as fast as when he won gold medals for the Columbia track team. In the fall of 1983, Harper & Row released his The Way of the Animal Powers, the first volume of a four-volume historical atlas of world mythology. As a child, Joe Campbell saw Buffalo Bill's Wild West show and visited the Totem Room at the Museum of Natural History in New York City. From these small yet powerful beginnings, Joseph Campbell's life's work began. Our lives are the richer for it. Join us for the next hour as we plumb the depths of mythic lore with the master himself, Joseph Campbell. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Joseph, welcome.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's always a real delight to me to have our conversations here at this station.
Well, surely it's a delight to me as well. Joseph, beyond the Buffalo Bill's Wild West show and the Totem Room at the Museum of Natural History, how did you really become, beyond that, become interested in mythology and the study of mythology? What happened?
Well, I think I would have to put it back to having been brought up a Roman Catholic and taking it very, very seriously as a boy, and realizing as I was reading the American Indian myths that the same forms were appearing there in a totally different culture context. And very early, I became interested in this comparative realization. And then in my university years, I was specializing in literature of the Middle Ages, and there the Arthurian traditions, and back of that, of course, the classical mythologies. These brought forth the same images again in a context that was that of the Christian tradition and yet inflected toward the more universal point of view that is that of the comparative approach. So this was it.
Much of your work is focused on the East, the Orient, and Oriental philosophies and the spiritual traditions of
yes.
the Orient. How did you first become interested in that area?
Well, that happened when I was a student in Europe. Actually, I met on a steamer back, I think it was 1924, Jiddu Krishnamurti and Raja Gopal, his friend, and his brother Nityananda, who died the next year. And that was my first encounter with the Orient at all. And a young woman who was on the boat was associated with them, and she gave me a copy of Edwin Arnold's Light of Asia, which is the life of the Buddha, which was the first I ever heard of all this. And then when I went to Europe as a student, I started, after a year in Paris, discovering modern art as well as doing my research in medieval material. In Germany, I started Sanskrit and just became fascinated, that's all. And later then, long years later, after I had been teaching and writing, I met Heinrich Zimmer, who was a major Indologist. And at the time of his death, his widow asked me to edit his American lectures, and I went way deep into the Orient. I also was helping Swami Nityananda edit the translate out of Bengali the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, and I knew Kumaraswamy and his work, and so it was a big load, and it all just opened this material out into vast, vast reaches.
Going back to your study of Native American lore and One of the myths that come out of the Native American tradition is the myth of the vision quest. And I'm wondering how you would relate the vision quest to Christian mythology. What would be the counterpart in Christian mythology?
Well, it is the counterpart of the mystical approach. What might be called the Pentecostal point of view, that one, through one's own inward experience, experiences the divine mystery in the way of one's own culture references and possibilities. This is the wonderful thing, I think, about the American Indian tradition, that sense of a divine realization possible to everyone, and one's whole life then is based on the experience of that vision. Whether the young man was to become a great warrior or a shaman or a chieftain is revealed to him at that time. So one finds one's own way through one's own experience, a way in the world in which one's living.
Why is appreciating such a myth important and relevant to the times we live in today?
Well, what I feel about the American Indian material is that for Americans, it's very important to know something about it, because mythology is rooted in the land as well as in the psyche. And our mythology has been brought from the Near East a very long, long time ago. It was put together. And it does not relate to our land unless we can, through our own experience, make it relate. Do you see? And if you do not have that experience, then the Holy Land is somewhere else. But the great realization of mythology is the imminence of the divine here, now. You don't have to go anywhere else for it. This is the Holy Land, the holy place, the holy moment. And I think that's a basic Christian experience in the land where Christianity emerged. But then as an import somewhere else, all the images have been alien. Do you see what I mean? And to find the Christ power here is the goal of such a meditation.
In some sense, we have the Native American tradition being kind of the mythic image of the land. And then the land became settled by cultures and peoples from many other traditions and societies and social milieus, and bringing a lot of different myths to the pot, as it were. And how do you see that as happened in America? I know you've written and talked about the idea that myth has been lost to us. Do you think that had something to do with it, the fact that this melting pot of various traditions coming into America produced a kind of a hodgepodge, no-myth society?
Well, the founding myth of the United States was the Christian myth in one sectarian form or another. Every state in the Northeast was formed by a sect that departed from the one next door and set up its own affair. But these are all variants of the Christian tradition. And this was a tradition that saw the truth as uniquely present in Christianity, and there was an actual degradation and denial of the possibilities of anyone else having the tradition, so that the deities of the Indians and the divine experiences were regarded as diabolical manifestations. I mean, one gets this all the time. I think that was a terrible thing to have happened. It led to the extinction of the Native American cultures here. Also, you can see in our roads these ribbons of concrete running across the continent, and I've driven across the continent many, many times, and you just pass through it. You don't absorb it. And the people who have moved into it have on their own to establish a relationship to the ground. They don't have any tradition for it. Do you see? I think that the movement now of the sort of realizing the importance of the land and respect for the land and how you can't violate it without violating your own life is something that represents a return of a realization that this is our land and we have to love it and deal with it in its terms somehow. But it may be too late, I don't know.
What about all this we hear about the deterioration or the disappearance of the nuclear family, the loss of family roots, and kind of, again, the melting into society of individuals with no ties to their ancestral heritage.
Well, there you see where we are. We're between two worlds, a world that is dissolving right around us. Everything is dissolving right around us. And the one that's to come hasn't shown its features yet. There's one aspect that I think is showing itself as potential but not realized, and that is that we are members of the community of the Earth. I say it's one community. The economic intercommunications, the fact that I was yesterday in Hawaii, you know, and my wife Jean is now in New York, having left yesterday from Hawaii, and I'm here. Or we could have gone the other direction and been in Tokyo or Benares. We're in one world. And I can remember the experience teaching when I began to have in my classes youngsters from India, you know, from Japan, from the countries that when I was a boy were just out of sight. It is one family now. But no one has the nerve to say so, you know. One sees that people pulling back to their in-groups. We're the right ones, we're the right ones. And it's splitting not only in terms of nations and races, but also in terms of economic classes. And no one has a sense of participating in a great organization and organism, which is that of humanity on this planet. But that's the challenge of today. And since mythologies all have to do with linking these eternal forms, which are those of the psyche and of the mysteries of the universe, to the contemporary life situation, the new myth has to move into the one world system.
Joseph, you mentioned the reality that we have become one world community, but we're still failing to recognize it. And it just brings up the idea of the need for new myths, and certainly one of the new myths is the idea of community and the extension of family, and perhaps even the return to an old one, the tribal life, as it were, because in many respects we see communities emerging around the planet that do have kind of almost like a tribal life style to them. What about that?
Well, the the problem is to realize you're a member of a small organism functioning as part of a large organism. And the problem of commitment of the smaller to the larger is the main one here, as I see it. The nation is something I think that is going to have to dissolve, but not the family unit. The family unit is an organic base. A lot of the crime, a lot of the troubles right now comes from the dissolution of the family. Everything's been thrown on the schools. We receive children who haven't learned how to behave decently as human beings, and it's supposed to be up to the school to inculcate ethics. That lies behind this whole prayer in the school problem. The prayer should be at home, not in the schools, because there are so many different prayer systems. And the fact that the children have to sit there and hear prayers recited to a deity who's not the name of the deity that is of their family, this I think is throwing the whole thing out of order. The family has to assume the responsibility, and I don't know how it can be brought about that people should feel that when they commit themselves to having children, it's their job also to take the responsibility that these grow up to be decent human beings.
So in some sense, what we're talking about is that kind of that in ages past, when a man's word was his bond and agreements were made verbally and not with extensive contracts, etc. It seems we've lost our understanding of integrity and ethics and values, and in many respects, that somehow our institutions have been inculcated with the institution is more powerful and more meaningful than human beings, and something has been lost in the process. And certainly, the mythic past has much to teach us in that respect, doesn't it?
Yes, but just primary human decency. I mean, something happened after the Second World War. It really did. And out of my own experience, which is simply that of the academic world, we couldn't keep books in the library. In a small college, the students are plundering the library, taking the books out. So now they've had to establish traps so that the book has some piece of metal in it or something. They walk through something, there's a buzz, here's a kid stealing a book. But the books I had to use for my course, for example, in comparative mythology, were often very difficult to get. And the librarian would get copies in, finally, and then next year we had to get new ones. The New York Public Library, I put in cards now for books, and, oh no, can't be found on the shelf. Or if I do get the book, the chapter I want has been ripped out by somebody. That never happened before. That never happened before. And this indicates a basic loss of a sense of the individual as a member of a community. It's, what have you done for me lately, you know?
And a disrespect for institutions.
And for themselves, yes. I would say. And for the person sitting beside them in the library. No, it's a very funny, strange thing, and it was in one generation that it happened.
Is it possible to recover?
I don't know. You know, when a house is broken, it's broken. In terms of that aspect of our situation, I'm pessimistic.
So as we look to the future, and we see ourselves in kind of a transitional society. Where do you think myth comes in a transitional society, which is kind of grasping at straws, as it were?
Well, myth comes in when you realize that the real judgment of life is not to be based on whether it's practical. The emphasis on practical, economic, and political ends leaves you without a ground, and the ground in the notion of what it is to be a decent and functioning and harmoniously put together human being. And it's that the myth has taught. I'm amazed reading some of these very, very, what we call primitive mythologies, at the sense of decency in the human being, in his relationship to other members of his community. Not the community outside, but his community. We've even lost that. So
what we're talking about is the idea that it's not enough to have a career and be successful monetarily in the world. There's more to life than that.
I think perhaps the economic emphasis, which is now very strong. For instance, in the colleges, the liberal arts departments are sinking, and everybody's going in for professional specialization, which does not tell you how to be a human being. It does not give you the rich information that comes through reading the classics, you know, Plato, Goethe, Shakespeare. Oh, what do we want with that, you know? What's the relevance? You know the term. And all this came in the 60s, as far as my experience goes.
Well, at the same time, there was a reemergence of the liberal arts in the 60s, but it kind of went by the boards in the last few years.
Well, I don't know what to say about the 60s. It was very politically oriented. There were two things that were going on there. One was blowing up the buildings on the campus, and the other was blowing up your own psyche with LSD. And there was a failure to experience the richness of things as they are, and also the privilege of living in this society, and knowing what it has given you, you know, in contrast to the others. If you've traveled around a little bit, you know what we've got. And this is something that can be lost. And they seem not to have realized that. I was terribly disgusted with the 60s. I was glad to get out. I never thought I'd be happy to retire from teaching, but I didn't like what was going on.
What do you see what's going on now? I mean, do you see that things have improved? Or
I'm not on the campus. I've been dealing with older people the past 12 years lecturing around, and this, to me, has been just beautiful.
But in many respects, the people that you work with in your workshops are people who came out of the 60s.
Yes, and they're trying to recover their humanity. That's it.
By coming to your workshops. That's one way. Yeah.
Really. There's a wonderful saying that a friend gave me to let you know you've reached that point in your life that's old. He said, you've got to the top of the ladder, and you found us against the wrong wall. Well, I've been dealing with people who found their ladders against the wrong wall, and everybody does. At a certain point, you realize there's another breakthrough to be made at this time. It's not that of the achievement of anything except an inward consciousness of my inward life and my relationship. And another thing that happens when you get to be a little older is you realize all the beauty you missed. I mean, that was a moment, that relationship with that person, and I didn't realize what it was. It goes on and on.
This recovery of one's internal depths, will that happen through the existing religious institutions or outside of saints?
Well, I think the religious institutions, as I have to say, they're so oriented to just, what can I say, social ethics as they understand it. And they see the devil as all over the place. I mean, I don't know any other tradition that has the devil in it to this extent. The formality of the religion instead of the experience of the divine within the other person over there, that's one of the wonderful things in the Orient. I mean, that greeting with the hands and the prayer gesture to the other person, that's a recognition of the divine power in that person. We don't see it in people. You know, we don't. And you do later on, you realize. I can tell you, that's the only regret I have in my life, that episodes and people and situations and moments of learning, I did not realize what the privilege was and what I was really not experiencing.
Well, there's a teaching in there for all of us, I think.
Yeah,
that's
a big,
we look at our lives.
Big point. And I think myth helps you to realize those things.
One of the things I think you said or wrote about, I can't recall which, but was in an article, I think, an interview with you, where you talked about the importance of relationship, and you talked about it in relative to meditation.
Yeah.
And how the meditation quest could be the death of relationship. What did you mean with that?
Oh, I was noticing, and this was way back, that when my friends would start to go to some meditation interviews with gurus or whatnot, 3 or 4 years later, I'd be hearing about their divorce. And this finding of the divine in yourself without seeing it in other people as well is what I think has come out of a good deal of this inward life meditation thing. Why isn't our relationship right here basis for a meditation of our, you know, common humanity? That's what we're talking about, isn't it? And that's what we're always talking about. And so I think for the Western person, where our social traditions don't insist on the relationship system as they do in the East, going then into inward meditation is a distraction from the world. Furthermore, the inward meditation in India, at any rate, belongs to the second half of life, not the first. And here are people who haven't even experienced life yet learning how to get out of it. It's not quite harmonious to our needs.
I recall that student that came up to you in one of your talks and said, Professor Campbell, what we're doing today is we're going from infancy to wisdom. And you said, what you're missing.
That was a shock to me, really. I have been talking about Dante and the stages of life, you know, moving from adolescence and so forth through the period of maturity, then to wisdom. And this youngster comes up at the end of the lecture and says, Dr. Campbell, you don't realize today we go directly from what you call infancy to wisdom. Well, I said, darling, that's really wonderful. All you've missed is life, you know? Well, that surprised me at that time, but I had three more youngsters during the course of that wonderful period, the 60s, come up with that one.
Joseph, that last anecdote about missing life certainly brings to mind the importance and the relevance of myth and exploring the depth and breadth of mythology to bringing us more in touch with how important it is to live life as fully and completely as possible. Because certainly all the mythic lore that we can come across is, at its essence, is that understanding, appreciation, and deep experience of life and all its richness.
Well, there's a good point here, Michael. This young lady thought, as a result of sitting at a desk in school year after year after year, that wisdom consists in knowledge, you know, knowledge obtained from books and from concepts. But it's the integration of this with life that really constitutes wisdom. And myths do not come from a concept system. They come from a life system. They come out of a deeper center. We must not confuse mythology with ideology, you know. Myths come from where the heart is and where the experience is. And the mind may even wonder why people believe these things. The myth is not pointing to a fact. The myth is pointing beyond facts to something that informs the fact. It's, as I've been saying to people who've been interviewing me lately, I've been on a trip for this book doing the publicity, and it has involved a lot of interviews with people who ask, what is a myth? It's amazing. And finally, I found out what's the problem. A myth is a metaphor that points beyond the image to a mystery, and I'll tell you what the mystery is in a minute. But when the metaphor is mistaken for the message, for instance, there was one interviewer who, finally I realized, he didn't know what a metaphor is, so he didn't know what I was talking about. And I said, well, give me an example of a metaphor. He was totally broken up. And finally, after fussing around, he comes out with, well, I'll try. He said, so-and-so runs very fast, and people say he runs like a deer. That's a metaphor. I said, no, that's not a metaphor. The metaphor is so-and-so is a deer. Well, he said, it's a lie, just as myth is. I said, no, it's a metaphor. Well, then when you think God is our Father, you think he is? That's a metaphor. And the metaphor points to two ends. One is psychological. That's why dream is metaphoric. It's metaphoric of the structures in the psyche. And your dream will have to do with the level of psychological realization that you are operating on, or that's pushing. And these levels can be deepened. The ultimate depth, however, is the metaphysical, pointing past all conceptualizations, all things and so forth. And so you have a double metaphor here. One is psychological, and the other is metaphysical. And when the two have brought together, where psyche and metaphysics come together, there you have a real myth. And then the whole of your life in the world, the sociological and the cosmological aspects, have to be revisioned in terms of these realizations. That's the function of the artist today. So there are two stages to this thing. One is going inward, finding the relationship of your own deepest ground to the ground of being so that you become, as it were, transparent to transcendence. And the other is then that of bringing this realization back into operation in the field. And that's the work of the artist, to interpret the contemporary world as experienced and as known in terms of this this relevance to our inward life.
Let me attempt to try a simple translation here. What we're talking about is the myth that we know about, the traditions and the kinds of lore that we'll find in your books, are the collective myths. These are the myths that have been collected over humanity's history. And what's important is for each of us to probe our own individual myth in relationship to that collective myth. Is that what you're saying?
Two aspects. One, to probe your own individual myth, and the other, to bring it into relation. You know, that's the function of meditation. That's the function of meditation, and that's the function of poetic and aesthetic insight.
So there's a very practical aspect to myth.
Well, you bet your life.
It's not just meant for the shelves of academia.
On the contrary, I mean, that's where it loses. And when it's reduced to that, all you have then is academic thinking, which I find that the real academic, the specialist academic, doesn't know what it's all about. They don't. The only reviews I've had of my book from professional anthropologists have been ridiculous. And the real reviews have come from humanists, from people who know what I'm trying to do.
Well, when we look at our entire educational structure, one notices that it's almost devoid of life experience. It's basically knowledge out of books.
That's correct.
That seems to be a big problem.
Well, that's something that every student really realizes at a certain point. You know, what in heaven's name am I going to do with this stuff? I can remember the day that occurred to me. I was in Paris, graduate school, studying Romance philology and medieval literature, and I was sitting in the Garden of Cluny there, where Bouvard Miche and Saint-Germain come together, and I thought, what in heaven's name am I doing? I don't even know how to eat a decent, nourishing meal, and here I'm learning what happened to Vulgar Latin when it passed into Portuguese and Spanish and French. I quit. That was where I really gave up the work on the PhD and took myth in another way.
Yeah. It seems that that's a crossroads that many people are kind of coming to these days. And many people find themselves at a transitional state in their lives when they're really looking at society's rules and traditions and laws, as it were, as the way you're supposed to act. And they're finding internally that there's something else they need to do.
Something missing.
But yet society has no, it's like there's no approval system there for that act. And so one does have to jump over the edge into the unknown and pursue one's own quest very much individually and alone.
Well, you might say, I have good news and I have bad news. You know, the good news is that you're free. The bad news is that you don't know what to do with it. We have been released from the crucifixion, you might say, of a society that is controlling our thought. That's what they're getting back there in Russia. We're free. But we've also lost the ones that tell us what the wisdom of the world was. And that's the advantage, I say, of a liberal arts education. You're at least put in touch with the thinking that has moved societies and mankind. However, when you go into a specialization in a certain field, even in an academic field, learning about, you know, the archaeological stratum in New Mexico on this level, and that's it, you're the specialist in that. Or as I knew one chap who had done his PhD thesis on the punctuation of Shelley's sonnets. I don't know what in heaven's name good this is. But you see, it was way along when it dawned on me that this had nothing to do with my life. There I had gone through 2 years of graduate work at Columbia. I was in 2 years in Europe. And how many students go along that far, you know? It's only then that I realized the inadequacy of this material that I was full of for life. I just dropped the PhD right at that point.
You know, going a little further with that point of living and life and life experience being so important and kind of returning to something we were talking about earlier, and that is relationship and the relationship of male and female particularly. And not only from a mythic point of view, which you're eminently qualified to talk from, but also from an experiential point of view, because you've had a successful relationship for 40-plus years now.
46 years.
With Gene Erdman, dancer extraordinaire. What's happening in these times when we see the emergence of the feminist movement, the assertion of woman power, the kind of return of the goddess, as it were, the patriarchal society we've lived in to some extent, and all of that wrapped up in relationship. What's happening to relationship around all of those kinds of changes that have been occurring over the past couple of decades?
Well, this is a big story,
yes, I know,
Michael.
Right?
And what I'm going to say, it may hurt me. But I think the women full of resentment, and I get too much of that feeling from this whole thing, they're not going back to the Mother Goddess at all, who is not resentment. She is a mother, and she knows how to relate. And the great power of the mother and of woman is relationships. She understands these things, not in terms of who's the winner here, but in terms of human values. And it's the male who represents, you know, achievement, and who's top boy in this club. And these women who now begin to want achievement have gone over into the patriarchal thing. They haven't gone back to the mother. Do you understand what I'm saying? They've accepted, so to say, the male ethos and have aligned themselves with it to the damage of their own female character.
What would be an example of this? Would this be an example of the woman becoming a telephone worker on the pole?
No, it has nothing to do with the work they're doing. It has to do with the inner attitude toward it. Now, I was in a wonderful seminar thing, and one woman spoke up, and she said that the way her mother had submitted to her father and had, as it were, given herself to him, taught her that this was not what she was going to do. Well, I thought, boy, what a husband she's going to get, you know. I mean, the whole thing of marriage is of relationship and yielding and knowing what the functions. Each is playing a role in an organism here. One of the things that I have realized, and that I think people in when they're long married do realize, is that marriage is not a love affair. You know, a love affair has to do with personal satisfaction and all of this immediate satisfaction. But as I've said time and time again, marriage is an ordeal. It's yielding. It's yielding, and that's why it's a sacrament. Because you're giving up your personal, what can we call it, simplicity, to participate in a relationship. And when you're giving to someone, you're not giving to that person. You're giving to the relationship. And if you realize that you are in the relationship as well as the other person, this thing then becomes what it truly can be. Namely, a life-building, a life-fostering, and enriching experience, not an impoverishment because you're giving to somebody else. Do you see what I mean?
Sure. It's a secret of giving generally.
Well, indeed. So I think this is a main problem. I know so many people marry just out of a love affair experience without realizing they're moving into a new dimension of life. And I think one can even say that that dimension has nothing to do with what may happen if you have, then following that, the crisis of a passing love affair here and there. You know, those do not conflict when they're properly understood. So these are complicated things.
Joseph, another thing myth does is it informs us about what stage of life we're in. What about that?
Well, that's one of the main functions of myth has been what I call the pedagogical, to carry a person through the inevitable stages of a lifetime. And the stages of a lifetime are the same today as they were in the Paleolithic caves. You're a youngster, dependent on parents and other authorities to teach you what life is and what your relationship to other people has to be, and where you are. And then you have to give up that attitude of dependence and receiving instruction, and not only instruction, but punishment and so forth, and become a self-responsible authority for what you do. In the old societies, your authority had to be in terms of the given order of that society. In our society, we are more creative. That is to say, we see new possibilities. The individual, however, has to evaluate and accept his evaluations and live in those terms. And then comes the stage of realizing I'm yielding. The world is in other hands. I'm moving on to another stage. And the myth tells you what the values are in those, in terms of the possibilities of your particular society. But you see, we don't have a mythology for our particular social order today. The myths belong to earlier times. And God, how things have changed, you know, just in my own lifetime. So we don't have the instruction. We're in a kind of free fall. All that one can be taught is how to be a decent human being, and then in the new situations, you have to work it out yourself, how to handle these things. But if you don't know what it is to be a human being, or what it used to be, even, to be a human being, then it's a free fall without knowing what strings to pull.
What about one of the important myths that's actually been created, I think, by industrial civilization, and that is that technology will solve our problems? And we're learning that technology hardly comes close to solving our problems. It may give us some blessings, but it also has some curses attached to it. What about, but yet that myth still is running rampant in our society?
This is the problem that Goethe dealt with in Faust. Mephistopheles is the man who can furnish the means to achieve any aim that Faust has. But Mephistopheles cannot determine what Faust's aims are going to be. And if Faust then gives up his notion of quest in terms of his humanity and just says, what aims can I achieve through these machines? He's lost his soul. That's the bet with Mephistopheles, that Mephistopheles could make Faust say, this is what I want. Now, one of the wonderful things I learned from George Lucas's films, you know, the
Star Wars,
he's dealing with the same problem. That's to say, the machine man, the man who goes not only for the machine, but for the system and becomes a robot, has lost his humanity. He is in the clutches of Mephistopheles. On the other hand, Mephistopheles can be in service. And the young man who then redeems his father, you might say, by taking off this social mask, you know, and seeing this undeveloped worm underneath, you know, is the son redeeming the father, because the son held to his humanity. He would not acquiesce in this kind of thing. This is the thing we're up against. The machine is a marvelous thing, and science is a marvelous thing, as a servant, not as a dictator. Do you see? And these monster states where the machinery that's necessary for this sociological thing to function, they're monsters. They're monsters. They're prison states. And we're in danger of losing this if we don't realize that the main thing is not social power, but humanity. And that's what myth talks about. And so, through the stages of life, where your humanity is as a child, as a mature person, and then in old age. Now, I'm 80, so that's usually thought of as an old man, though I don't say I feel that way. But I know darn well what the values are that are coming to me now, you know? And if I were still striving for what I should have been striving for some time ago, which is what happens very often with people, you know, you would have lost the value of your time.
Another aspect of that technology conquers all is how it's led us into a dichotomy between us and our environment and nature, that somehow we can control nature, we can overcome nature. And in that lies a repudiation of much of what we learn from myth.
Well, on the other hand, you know, as I say, I think the ecological movement is beginning to realize that we are in cooperation with nature. And that what science has done has been to learn what makes nature click and advance into that field in our own terms, making it function for us, but also in relation to. Because if you dismiss the nature claims, you're going to turn yourself and everybody else into robots. It's a very interesting balance. Not going back to nature and yielding, becoming, you know, its victim again, but in play with it, and not dominating, but in play with. It's not an easy lesson. But I must say, when I saw those films of George Lucas and realized that he had identified the problem and was rendering it in what are really mythological images. That's a mythological theme, the son at one with the father, you know, and redemption of both thereby.
Of course, those films have been among the more successful films of recent years.
And why? Because
they're touching chords.
Deeply, one realizes this is it today. It today. I won't say that they are mythological, but I will say that they are in the language of myth and dealing with mythological problems. They're more like epics, you know, which are stories for entertainment and instruction within that field.
So 21st century Gilgamesh.
Something of that kind, yes. Yeah. No, I was thrilled.
We have a couple minutes left, Joseph, and perhaps in the final minutes remaining to us, what would be your projection of how this transitional society we find ourselves in will move forward in coming years? And mythology, what will be the role of myth?
Well, the role of myth will be what it has always been, and that is to render in contemporary terms the mysteries of our own inward life, the psychological ground, and the relationship of these mysteries to the cosmic life, because we're all parts of the cosmos, and our energies of our psyche come from God knows where, through the organs of our body. So myth's got to deal with the human system in relation to the mystery of the universe in terms of here and now today. And this here and now today, as I see it sociologically, is what I said right in the beginning of this talk. We're members of a society of the planet, not of this particular place. And the fact that the main three religions of the Western world, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, can't live together in Beirut, in one town, because each thinks, I've got it. This is a refutation of all three of them in terms of their value for the contemporary world. They're monstrous. And, I mean, the picture in that city tells you that these things have to crack up and realize that man is saying in his language what I'm trying to say in mine. And you get a brotherhood. And you get a cooperation. And unless that comes, we're going to blow ourselves to smithereens. We got the means to do it. And those same means are the things that are pulling us together. So there's the ambiguity of science again.
Well, mythology certainly provides the tools to meet the challenge.
It sure does. The best thing it can do by studying it is to realize that what that person is saying is what my teachers were saying also in another language. That's what I think is the service of the comparative study of religions, to realize it's the same, not different.
Joseph, I want to thank you for being with us once again. It's been a pleasure, as always.
And for me, Michael, as always. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Joseph Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Sarah Lawrence College, author of The Masks of God, Hero with a Thousand Faces, and The Way of the Animal Powers, Volume 1 of the Historical Atlas of World Mythology. My name is Michael Toms. I'm wishing you lots of myth in your life.